2, A.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and this is Second Sight NYC. We will be broadcasting live on UFO Paranormal Radio on June 18th between 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will be covering the 2011 Paranormal Expo in Auburn, New York, live.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George. Join us as we interview the who's who of the paranormal world, as well as many of the other guests attending the event. This is sure to be a fun-filled 2 hours, so you can all expect the unexpected.
We'll be conducting exclusive interviews with high-profile guests.
And as always, you can expect us to keep it real.
Join us
in the fun.
The Church of Mabus radio show is now in session, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern, with High Strange Scholars teaching us of ufology, the paranormal, the occult, and the metaphysical. Seek sanctuary with the Dark Reverends, Jeffrey Pritchard and Guy Widell, at www.mabusincarnate.com, always moshing with the apocalypse. Now get down on your knees and pray!
Tri Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Then please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti.
And we're Second Sight NYC, a psychic and paranormal radio show based out of New York City.
And Chris is a psychic that tells it like it is.
So if you want something sugar-coated,
just buy a donut.
Each week we'll have an interesting guest, and I'll do psychic readings and dream interpretations with a psychic twist.
We touch on all that is paranormal, from exorcisms to ghost hunting.
From seances to passing spirits in the light.
Yeah, and sometimes Chris gets a little carried away.
But Stephanie's always there to reel me back in. We're making the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
I had had enough.
Well, you drove out there into the middle of nowhere and had some sort of loud verbal display challenging E.T. in general out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. I actually had a pistol in my hand at the time. I was really ticked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.
He was a Louisiana man named Montaldo. The folks around called him Six Gun Joe. Worked with ICAR, don't you know? Investigating UFOs. Out for a drive with a gal one night, they stopped to check out a reporting site. When an alien lit right there on the ground, commenced to throw in his weight around. Now, old Six Gun didn't take too kindly to that kind of thing, especially without Vaseline or anything like that, you know. Seriously. Well, Six Gun looked that critter right in the eye and said, "Any last wish before you die, y'all?" Reached for his gun, quick as a twitch, and said, "Fill your claw, you son of a bitch." Now a legend spread across the land about this pistol-waving man. But if you're from space or from Earth below, you don't give no lip to Six Gun Joe. Oh,
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to UFO Undercover. Like Natasha says, I am your host, Joe Montaldo. I hope everyone's having a great evening, great morning, great afternoon, wherever you are on our beautiful blue planet. You guys, I say this every week, I love doing this show. Come on, 144 countries, every time zone on the planet, 1.5 million weekly listeners. I'm a happy camper, okay? If I get a check, I'd be a much happier, but still, I'm a happy camper. We are making a difference. I see iCar terminology and logo throughout the field now. All of our directors are making good headway. I gotta say, in general, I've been pleasantly surprised by the radio station, and I've been extremely pleasantly surprised by iCar. Both of them have grown quite well, and both are now steeped in the ufology field. And the reason all this happened, I'll make it short because I have our guests on the line with it, but the reason all this happened, guys, is because frankly, there was no venue for people like myself and the guests on and other people, other than a select few groups. And if you're not part of the Good Old Boys Club, you're not gonna get to speak in those groups very often. You might get a call every once in a while, come to a lecture or something like that if you got something new or something good. But in general, it's pretty much a good old boys club, and it's a tight-knit group, and they travel on, which actually a lot of them are friends of mine, so I don't want to hate on them, and a lot of them are excellent speakers. But to be honest with you, the meat and potatoes of what we do, ladies and gentlemen, are the abductees and the contactees. This is what it's about. We can chase flying saucers in the skies till we blue in our face. It's not going to make a difference. We can catch them, capture them, bring them to Washington. It's not going to make a difference. Until the aliens actually face up or we get enough information from abductees to prove the point, it's not going to make a difference. It'll make a difference to people like me and guests and other people, but in general, to the general population of the planet, they're not going to care. Okay? So, you know, that's what we do now. We put this out every day to whoever wants to listen to it. Last week, as a matter of fact, I was just going over the stats of the radio station just about 15 minutes ago. Last week, we did 6.7 million listeners for the entire week, which is outstanding. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of broadcasting nonstop. You know, archives are nonstop. Oh, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, two things before I change over here. One, the archive site will be back up on midnight on the 27th. I was going to turn it back on today, but I'm not going to pay $500 for 2 days, guys. Sorry. So y'all are going to have to wait to 2 days. And I am very happy we are blowing up bandwidth, but in the same time I'm not, because it's causing me a problem and money. Secondly, a couple of, we'll touch those at the top of the hour. Great. Tonight's guest is Thomas Reed. Most of y'all on this network should be familiar with him. He's been on the network twice that I know of. He's been on a couple of our friend shows like Jerry Pittman and Kevin Smith, so y'all should be. He's also spoke for MUFON, and he was one of MUFON's cases, which we'll get into in a little while. So for the average listener or anybody who's been in the field for a while, y'all should be familiar with him. I have to say, though, I was not until Jeffrey Pritchett, Church of Mavis, introduced me to him. I was not familiar with the case, which is shame on me because I was with MUFON for 10 years back in the day. So I got to say, but Thomas, welcome to the show, man. Thomas? Thomas? Okay, we might have lost a guest here, guys. I don't know what's up with that. Okay, what's up? I don't hear nothing. Thomas? I guess we lost him then. Well, hold on for a second, ladies and gentlemen. Let me go find our guest right quick, and I'll see what happened with that.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the sky?
Montaldo. Okay, ladies and gentlemen,
hopefully this is resolved. We had to do a little putting some phones in encrypted mode so that, you know, they won't go disappearing on us. Tom, can you still hear me okay?
I'm here, buddy. How are you?
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Reed is with us. He's a cross-generation multiple contactee, but I'm going to get Thomas to introduce himself, and that way y'all can get a little bit more familiar with him. But like I said, he's you can find him, information on him on MUFON. You can find him on Mabus, Joiner, pretty much all the regular places, Kevin Smith, Jerry Pittman. So if you want to catch up and find out who he is, what he's about, go ahead. There's several topics him and I will be crossing. I'm going to tell you a little secret before I give him the mic. Thomas and I had actually scheduled to talk to each other prior to doing an interview because the stuff that we wanted to talk about, like the blood type study and other things, that really would probably have been better off the air, but you know what? Y'all are going to get to hear at least part of this conversation tonight. So, Thomas, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
Just tell the audience a little bit about yourself and why you're in all of this, and then we'll go from there.
All right, sure. My family had an experience, or my mother did, long before I was born in 1954 in Moosehead Lake in Maine. Well, she was there with some friends and some other family. And she didn't actually even tell us about it until I was about 6 or 7 years old, when we had, my brother and I came along and had an experience in 1966, and then two others that followed. And over the years, or the years to come, my father ran in for office and was a politician, an attorney, because of his political involvement, we really never really spoke too much about it. Although Robert Bleckman, who was an attorney, actually discussed our case in 1992 at the United Nations, although it was still kind of hush hush. And with that said, over the years, my brother and I have all had sons, three sons, and as it would turn out, for the longest time, we had never really connected the dots here, if you will, or maybe there's no dots to connect, but or certainly I'll speak about my son. He's been shown to have some remote viewing abilities, nothing outrageous, but simple, you know, little things that he shouldn't be able to do, has really excelled in a lot of his schoolwork and that sort of thing. And then we never really thought too much about it. And then in 2009, my brother's youngest was turning six, about the same time these things seemed to take some type of a pattern to it, his child, right around 6 years old, was in Brownsburg, Indiana, where my brother was leaving a movie theater, and that was the case that has really brought all this to light, which has got so many people looking back over it now and going through it and saying, yes, there's a pattern here. In 2009, they found radiation, magnetic fields. There was a UFO that was a couple of crafts over a week's period where this took place with my brother, caught on radar, witnesses from the ground. It was investigated by several different groups, and that's really where we are. I mean, it would appear now, as you look over it, that there is a pattern, and that's what we are looking to try to find what that pattern is. There's been a lot of speculation, you know, there's been these abductions over 40 years, and no, it really wasn't. There was a few in 1966, one with my mother in 1954, and then some rare abilities developed with our children, and then, of course, this incident in 2009, which just, at that point, you really have to take a good look at this and say there's really something to it.
Well, you know, there's so much to all of this. When I was listening to you talk, you know, because I've heard you talk a couple of times now, and I know there's a lot of parallels between my personal case and yours, which I find interesting, but there's not all that many of them out there. Maybe it's because we're closer in age or something, but it's just kind of a weird thing. And when I was listening to you talk to you something just before we got on the show, we were talking a little bit about it. You know, when we look at family lines, because that's how when we deal with adoptions, we only look at family lines, because after all the research we've done, we know it runs in family lines. It's not random like a lot of researchers think, or this person or that person being abducted. It's not even close to how it works. They're definitely inside of family lines, and they're in there for certain reasons. And we also learned that the amount of abductions or the frequency of abductions are going to be dictated by the usefulness of the individual or their siblings or their friends or their family or however they happen to be
affiliated with all of it, which still to this day fascinates me. And again, if you're aware of, recently we found out that personalities and blood types and eye colors and all directly correlate to alien abductions in a very vast way, too. And it's a very interesting thing. And while I'm thinking about that, a doctor friend of mine sent this to me the other day because I had posted a question to him about, was O negative blood, could you not clone O negative blood? And he wrote back to me, he said, no, you can't clone O negative blood. But he corrected me, you can't clone Rh negative blood, it's not just O negative. But any of the Rh negative can't be cloned, but Rh positive blood can be cloned, ladies and gentlemen. This is just another little thing, like recently we found some information about ADP and ADDH and things like that happen to run prominent in A positive families, and even the doctors in the field happen to be prominent in A positive. But very few are contactees. So it's interesting some of the stuff we've been learning with all of this. And I know for you, you've been dealing with this on and off for a while, but before we get into anything deep, personally, if you could make the, I always ask everybody this, and I don't get offended by it, but if you could personally make this stop tomorrow and just say blank, blank, no more involvement, no more nothing, and just wipe the whole thing from your family, would you do it?
Yeah, sure I would. But then again, there's still, I say that because of how we've had to deal with it and suppress it and not mention it or talk about it until recently, but as far as my son's abilities, he's almost beginning to have some fun with it, so he would probably feel differently.
Well, he probably would, because, you know, I tell people all the time, I do construction for a living and I do radio and investigation work, and I got to be honest with you, my empathic abilities I put to use every day, every day. And I gotta say, most of the time they're pretty much on and pretty much right there. You know, we find that, like, you probably possess a decent empathic, telepathic ability, but it's probably very, very suppressed. Mainly because it just wasn't encouraged to be developed. See, you sound more like you're gonna encourage your son with this, which will triple or even quadruple how fast this develops. And I gotta tell you, a lot of the ET's abilities that we possess are very useful in day-to-day life. I've been amazed. You know, audience, just for a second, so y'all know where this all comes from. When I got involved with this field many, many, many moons ago, I thought all these people were nuts, I'm going to be honest with you, including myself. I was looking at God. I was looking at religion. I was looking at everything but ET to find out where these abilities come from, how I got to where I was, and why certain things were happening in my life that I couldn't explain at the time. It took me a long time to realize that this was other than, you know, some kind of deity or demon or something along those lines, or something other than I understood. But around 28, I really did. I had a severe awakening. But in my family, we were very lucky because we have a very psychic family, and it's very well accepted inside the family. Weird experiences and psychic abilities is inside the family. Matter of fact, we used to have a little thing on the table at the house, say whoever got the most phone calls, most doors, and most answers right would get the little pocket change at the end of the week, right? Me, my sister, and a few other members in the family, anybody would call, everyone knew who it was on the phone. And that was before caller ID. Or who's knocking at the door, who was coming in. It's a really weird thing. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I wanted to see if have you run across any of this in your own family. Latent psychic abilities or things that seem to be out of the normal for everyday, I guess, everyday people.
With me personally or with my family in general?
You and the family in general. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I would have to stick with my son. I mean, he, just to give you an idea, there was a couple of instances, but there was one where he thought our neighbor was in harm. For no reason, he jumped out of bed around 2 o'clock in the morning. Told me he described this little white Toyota with no rims on it, and then there were four people that he could describe very well driving through our neighborhood, which is a gated community at the time it was, and had no business being there, and that he, you know, we were in danger, and I had a bass tracker, a little boat on the side of my house, and that was no longer there. And he was truly scared. And this was back in 2005. And, you know, so I put him back to bed and everything, you know, of course. But, you know, there at times, you know, you think, wow, he's really, really adamant about this. And so about a week later or so, not even a week, his football coach actually bought my boat. So we didn't have the boat, which I had no intentions of selling. And then we were on the front porch, and sure enough, this white Toyota with no hubcaps, just the way he described it, came through the neighborhood. And he was actually flabbergasted, for lack of a better word, and scared almost. It was one of the first times this had really happened, where he really was faced with something that he saw ahead of time. And later on, about 2 or 3 days later, our neighbor, Nancy, had been robbed. So there was something to that. I mean, that wasn't just a freak occurrence. And there was another time that my parents, he had, this wasn't that late. This was about 10 o'clock at night. And he said, you know, you need to call Pop-Pop, is how he, this was even before that. And I said, you know, why, what's up? And he said, there's someone in their house or their garage or something. And so I called my mom, you know, and she answered the phone, and I said, are you guys okay? You know, just checking on you. You know, Chris has got some things running through his head. No, we're fine. So I thought, okay, we hung up the phone. The next morning, I got a call around 6:30 in the morning from my father. They lived across, diagonally across the street from a convenience store. It was robbed, and they followed the footprints to a barn on our parents' property. That was not a coincidence. It's just, and this was, they live, or at the time, they lived about 3 to 4 hours away. On top of that, he's hit 61% on Zenicards. He has scored 27% in the entire nation, and he's well in the superior range in his school testing. And he's been shown to possess remote viewing abilities by a PhD when he was tested not even a year ago again, after going to the Miami Children's Hospital for a review and some tests as well to see where he stands and places with this stuff. It's not anything that is, you know, there are little things, but it's all the time. And as far as mathematical ability and numbers and things like that, he's off the charts. I mean, he was doing high school formulas in fourth grade. He actually represented the Palm Beach County School Board in a series of, you know, they take the brightest children and they go on and they challenge other schools or what have you, and he represented his school for that. So now, to be honest with you, I can have these little things where, you know, like everyone else, you think, you know, that song's going to come on the radio first, but anything above that, I really haven't had that experience. But the crazy thing about this is that my brother's children seem to have that same ability, but my son is actually the strongest with it. Now, I'll tell you one more thing that I've never mentioned anybody, which really may not have any bearing on this, but he's also a starting quarterback for his high school. And he is, because he's so darn intuitive. He seems to know things are good, you know, he knows where to go with things, he knows what's going to happen, and he's very adamant about the fact that he believes that. So, and it seems to be working out well for him. So there are things with my son that are at a different level than anyone else in my family.
Well, no, that actually should be that way, though. He's probably part of a different lot group, which I'll get into later. But for us, everything you just said, I expect to hear from anyone out of a contactee family. Everything you said, I
really
expect to hear. I've got to be honest. Yeah. It's most of the contactees now. This does go, and it is different in different families, and I don't exactly know why, because, you know, like for me, it was very weird growing up. You know, I went to private schools, math and science, like seldom to me, it was just easy stuff. You know, people were like, friends of mine were like, oh my God, dude, what are you doing? It was easy, easy stuff. We expect contactees to have above average IQs. We expect them to be empathic. Matter of fact, usually if they don't show any type of kinetic abilities, we have to wonder if they're actually contactees. Because each one doesn't even seem to bother with I think it's easier for them.
Yeah. Well, just to give you an idea, I mean, my son's IQ is like 140, and the rest of our family's well over 129. So, and my one's 3 points below genius, which is like 147. So, we're all up there for some reason. Why, you know, that is, I don't know. But
that's contact D. Like I said, I expect to see that in a family of contact D. Contact D is a bad word because we really need new terminology in the field. But what goes on here is somewhere 10,000, 50,000, 100,000, a million, how many ever years ago it was, ET directly intervened in your family line. Whether it was the great or reptilian, the human, whoever it was, they directly intervened in your family line. Now what they're doing is most people don't even realize this. Grays live a very, 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 very long time. The same gray that picks you up might be the same gray that picked up your great, 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 great grandpa. Okay, and it's really interesting to me because they really get an understanding of a family and how a family works and what's involved with that family and what they're going to expect out of that family in the future. It's for them, it's part of what they're doing. For us, it's all like, what the hell's going on? But for them, this has been going on for a long time. And we started finding this out because, right now we have cases that span six generations in one family. So actually in several families, we have six generations and five generation cases. So we have the great-grandmother and the great-granddaughter and everybody that's being abducted in between. And you can see where the great-grandmother's abilities are versus the great-granddaughter's ability, and there is an increase exponentially along each generation. Now, some of these generations are stronger because maybe their original family line was interfered with sooner or later than the others, meaning, somebody may have gotten, family might have gotten messed with 50,000 years ago, and somebody's family might have gotten messed with 49,000. 48,000, so there might be a slight difference in there. And I think they did that on purpose to lay out how this is going to fall out for them. This is the hardest thing to make anybody who's being abducted or contacted understand. This is not about us. This is about them. It's about us and the fact that we're being taken. This is about them, though. What they're looking for, what their agenda is.
I've got a feeling on that, too. I've got a feeling on that, too, that it's not so much something that's needed from us, which I believe that's true. I believe that there is something that we have that they need. But feeling, or our family's feeling, is also that there is some form of blending or something being given back as well, which is why I go back to the fact that I think they played a big part in our human progression from way back when.
Yeah.
I think that, that there is some form of let me ask you this, since you're more absolutely more versed in this than I am. If it was possible for some form of genetic or DNA or something that was exchanged in some form or way that would cause this to happen to so many of us, and certainly my son, then that DNA would have had to match. You follow me? I mean, there would have had to been, or would have been rejected. Which means to me that there have to be some part of us to begin with, which is maybe why, we've got nine members in our family that are Rh negative. My son is A negative. I'm O negative. My ex-wife was AB negative, and most of rest of my family is A negative. So it just seems kind of peculiar that we have nine members of our family all Rh negative. We all seem to be very intuitive, some much more than others. But if this was in fact, and obviously, how can I say for sure that this truly is, or say, okay, this was because of this? I can't do that because I don't know, but I know that something here is really happening, and it it comes from somewhere. And if I do go out on a limb and say yes, and what the
Thomas, an illusion?
I'm sorry.
I thought I lost you for a second. No, go ahead. Yeah, all right. It just got real quiet suddenly. I didn't like that.
I'm sorry. But it would have to. There would have to be a link for this to happen to us and our bodies not to reject whatever it is that was taking place.
Well, that's a very good point. And as our doctor friend Carlos always tells me, there's no doubt if this is all true that there's a direct line of descendancy between us and them. Somewhere, whether it was physical interbreeding or if they were just taking embryos and we are the hybrid, basically. I try to make the contactees on, he's talking about hybrids. We're the hybrids. That's what we are. All the contactees are hybrids. We're a human and gray or reptilian or human hybrid. That's what we are. We're combined with them. And what's really funny about this part now, Thomas, is 50,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago when this all started, there was gray contactees, reptilian contactees, human contactees, human alien contactees. Well, since then, their children have started breeding together where somebody's family may be contacted by the Greys Are Life, and then all of a sudden one of their kids decides to marry a reptilian contactee. Well, they have kids. Well, this kid is now reptilian Grey contactee and possesses quite a bit more abilities than normal. That kid may marry into a human contactee family, which again may have kids and marry back into the Grey family. They have created a whole sub-population beneath the entire human population. I don't know what it's for, because after that point we're just speculating, but it's there. And I was working with two doctors, but Dr. Carlos wrote to me a couple of days ago, and he's interested. As a matter of fact, he was listening, because he just sent me a comment about what you just said. And they think that there's some kind of direct DNA thing, and it really kicks all of this off. You have three types of aliens, you have three types of blood types.
I'm sure that started way back when, early on, the pyramids, everything else, if you want to get into that. But, we are so much more advanced than any other culture. I mean, I think this has been kind of going on for a long time. For us to have IQs of 140 and the closest, living animal to us has, 10? So, this is coming from somewhere. And
That's the whole point. I mean, they're integrating. The families are smarter. Everybody in our family has above average IQ. Everybody in my wife's family has above average IQ. And they range anywhere from the 130 range to the 170 range, which is very nice, and it's a very bright family. But, ladies and gentlemen, before y'all take this out of context, IQ just means you have the potential, okay? It doesn't mean you're smarter, faster, or brighter. It just means you have a faster potential to get there. Someone with an IQ of 100 will have to work three times as hard to achieve the same thing as someone with a 170. But it doesn't mean that the other person's actually any smarter. It just means it's easier for them. Like, math and science are second nature to me, but most of my friends would tell you I'm the lousiest speller you'll ever see. And as far as grammar goes, we just threw that out the window totally. So it's just how it is amongst contactee groups, and it's a very interesting thing in itself. But you see, that's another point, Thomas. See, we're all Rh negative, and we've been talking about this a long time, and a lady writes to me, well, I'm a contactee, and I'm A positive. Well, just because you're positive doesn't mean you're not a contactee. But what we've learned in the last 2 years, from 3,000 or 4,000 contactees now, is that they prefer Rh negative. They just prefer them, and I think it's for a reason. I actually think they're breeding it that way. They probably are the ones that created the Rh negative. Prior to 25,000 years ago,
I believe that too. I think you're right on. I mean, the O negative. I mean, interrupt you. There's a little bit of delay. So the Rh negative from, and I've been looking into this more and more and more, because our family has said, okay, it's been long enough. There has got to be a tie and a link, something here that we can identify, and it seems to be that the Rh negative factor does play a part in it. There's some strange symbolisms and things of that nature, like willow trees. For some reason, it seems to, as crazy as that sounds, there's something to that. Our family all has willow trees and buys homes with willow trees. If they don't have them, they plant them. And that was shown to us back in 1966 on the crap. So this big display of a willow tree on a lake. So that, for some reason, has embedded itself. But and every time we see one, we're reminded of it, if you will. But as far as the Rh negative and O negative, the cells are completely clean. There's no additional sugars or coppers on them, and so it's not the prominent blood type. If you marry or someone with an A positive blood, you that's going to overtake and drive your child's blood will be A positive, not A negative. So for an Rh negative blood cell, it's basically pure. There's nothing on it. There's nothing from monkeys. It's just there, and it's a pure, clean cell. There's no byproducts some form of a coating on a cell. I don't know if you know that. I'm sure you do know that. It's just a pure cell, which is why you can give it to anybody, because there's nothing for the body to reject. But when you have such a pure,
whoops. Did we lose you, Thomas? Thomas. You lost him, guys. We might get him back in a second. We'll hang out for a minute and see if he comes back. Yeah, he's been having, they've been hitting his phone lines. I got the Skype running through the 128-bit encryption on the laptop. I'm hoping that'll hold that up. And I got my phone scanning through my system so it don't get locked, but it's not his. Thomas, can you hear me okay? If not, I'll call him back in a couple minutes, guys.
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, there you go. You're back. Okay. Yeah, I got you now. We just lost you for like 2 seconds there, 3 seconds there.
Okay.
I figured you'd come back. It was like you faded. Go ahead.
This is not the first time it's happened, but anyway, I don't know what you heard last, but my thought on this is that yes, the red blood cell, Rh negative red blood cell, is clean. It doesn't have anything on it, no sugars, no coppers, so it's pure. And so therefore you can give it to anybody, but you can't receive anything but O negative, because that cell is so clean that it'll reject anything that is attached to another blood cell from A positive or B positive or what have you. So it is a pure, pure red blood cell. It's as pure form as it gets.
Well, it is, and it's one of the great things about it. It's one of the very first things the doctor explained to me. He said, you know why, he was saying this, why Rh negative is a universal donor. He was explaining how pure the blood was, and there's no rejection, and that's why everybody gets it. But Rh negative people, unfortunately, can only take Rh negative blood. But even he, you know, what you were just saying, he described it as something created in a lab. He said it was too clean, too pure. He said it resembles something that if you created it in the lab, not that Mother Nature created it, is what he was trying to get across.
Right.
He doesn't think, along with several people I've talked to in the last few months, they don't think that the Rh negative is naturally occurring. They don't know where it came from, but they don't think it's naturally occurring. They think it was interjected into our gene supply. They just don't know how. They don't want to talk about aliens because they're doctors and aliens scare them. They might mess their careers up a little bit. But when we're on the phone or when we're talking in chat, it's different. They'll kind of lean more towards maybe it is aliens, but as a professional, I understand they have to keep a job. You know, I really do. But even as professionals, they're saying they do not believe that this Rh negative is naturally occurring. They don't think that, Rh negative. They just don't think, you know, because they all ask the same question, where did it come from? If it was from Mother Nature, why did Mother Nature, why for thousands and thousands of years we had A and B and positive and nothing else, and then O, and then still positive and nothing else? Why was it? And then all of a sudden, 35,000 years ago, out of the blue, we get O negative blood and green eyes. By the way, there were no green eyes prior to that either. You know, it's almost like somebody came in and infused their DNA into eyes directly and changed our species because...
Right.
Okay.
Which I believe, and which why it would have to be that there is also a genetic link, or we could never have had that happen.
Yeah, we're for lack of a better term, we're married to them somehow or another. And there does seem to be, like I said, you know, I know people always write to me about the 56 types of aliens. People, please quit doing that, okay? Because there's no proof for that whatsoever. It's not that I don't think there's more than 3 types of aliens in the universe or in the galaxy. I think our galaxy is teeming, and I do think there's probably some kind of group council or something out there, but I don't think they're all visiting Mother Earth, okay? There's only 3 prominent types of ships, the saucers, the triangles, and the elongated saucers. And then there's about 50 types of probe, but they're all basically either teardrop, egg-dropped, or round-shaped. Different colors and stuff like that. But there's no real suggestion of a lot of a multitude of, like, you know, 50 different styles of spaceship coming here. There ain't none of that. And frankly, there's only 6 types of aliens that even have more than one witness being seen. So you got to be skeptical, guys, when you start hearing things like that. And I think it would be a lot harder to keep a secret if there was that many aliens visiting on the planet. I'm just not going to buy that one. It doesn't matter what dimension they're from. If that many aliens were coming to the planet, everybody would know about it. Unfortunately, government can't keep secrets about Afghanistan. So you ain't keeping those kind of secrets. 3-4 races there that can threaten them, they can keep that a secret. But a bunch of races that they can't control and run around the planet and do whatever they want, that we'd already know about that. And to be honest with you, Thomas, I don't think ET cares if anybody else knows. All I think they're worried about, they've done their disclosure. Contactees know that's their job. They've disclosed to the people they want to disclose to. As far as the rest of the 9 contactees on the planet, ladies and gentlemen, don't take this the wrong way. I really don't think they care about y'all in any shape, form, or fashion. I think they don't think of y'all any more than they think of an ant walking down the street. I just don't think there's anything that they care about there. And I think the only reason they care about contactees is there is a blood relation somewhere along the line. And I think that, you know, besides the experiments they're working towards, other than that.
Yeah, well, they have an agenda. I mean, they're here.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This isn't sporadic. I mean, if I can interject for a moment, I want to share something with you. In 66, my brother was with me. He was 4 years old. And when we were in this hallway, which looked like a square illuminated tube, basically, the area I was in was wider, and off to the right there was a tube there where my younger brother was standing there with a being to his left, and I was taken past him, and I was brought up this hallway into this other room that joined a larger room where I was kind of handed off, almost like like an escort, and just, you know, he got me to where I needed to go and relinquished me at that point. And I looked around for my brother because, you know, he was younger and kept turning for him and so on, and they took him out of sight. And I was worried about him, you know, I was like, where did you go and that sort of thing. And they picked up on that. They knew that I was concerned for him, and so it wasn't a cold thing. It wasn't as if they really didn't care at that point, but we were very young. The second time this happened, which was about 9 months later or so, I was taken and my brother was not. He was left behind, and this was witnessed by several people that were in our house, grandmothers from Hollis, Queens that were visiting and everything else. This was in 67. I thought my brother was taken out of sight, and I was started to not cooperate. Normally there's this like calm that kind of encompasses you and keeps you cooperating in some way, that there's no fear and it's okay, and to make you feel as if you're important, you know, that you're there for a reason and you're needed. And that's the way I felt at the time. I could have misunderstood it, but that's what I felt. There was no verbal anything. There was a touch. There were images projected and that sort of thing. But where I'm going with this is that I was not cooperating, if you will, or receptive to this. I was very agitated because my brother was gone again. And it got to the point where I know that there was a frustration there. So they do have feelings, and they do get frustrated, just so you know. And from my experience, and I'm not saying that what I experienced is what someone else did, but there was a frustration. There was it got colder, but I'll tell you this, my brother showed up about, and I don't know how long it was, but my brother showed up shortly after, and my mother and grandmothers and so on, family at the house, all remember that happening, and that's for, I guess, another conversation, but they brought him to me, and then I don't know what happened there, there's a lot in the middle, I don't remember, but we were then brought and left in a part of a driveway near a barn, and my grandmother had seen us from a porch where she was looking at. They had floodlights on, and there we were. So my what I want to add to that is that there is some form of compassion, and there is a way to frustrate them just like us, which tells me that, you know, they have feelings, and they're probably, like you said, much more connected to us than a lot of people want to accept. Mm-hmm. I hear all the time, well, they're spirits or demons or this or that. No, they're really not. They're not that much different. They're just extremely more advanced, and that's my feeling on it. And again, that doesn't make me right, but that's my feeling on it. From what I saw, there was compassion, there was frustration, and the tone and the atmosphere changed. So I just wanted to share that with you because I haven't really expressed that before. I kind of keep to what I can document rather than just opinions. But since we're sharing here, I just wanted you to understand how I feel about it.
No, that's cool because, I was taught in the early days when I was with MUFON, by the way, oh, great, you don't have no emotions. And then I experienced them for myself, and I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. But no, like Jim Sparks and I talked about this about a year ago, the greatest have emotions, they, you know, I guess the best way we could describe them maybe is like a Vulcan or a Vorlon. So they do have very good control of them, but they do lose their temper from time to time. Every now and then you will see one crack a smile or a laugh. But in general, they go around kind of, because they're in each other's head so much that I don't think that their facial expressions aren't like ours, meaning that they're in each other's head so much, I think even when they're laughing or angry, it's not so much showing outward, but inward. So I don't think a lot of us have even experienced it. But I do, I have personally seen them. Yeah,
you sense it more than you see it.
Yeah, and it's right? A good way of saying it. Yeah, you do sense it more than you feel it. And, but you know, I have personally seen them just actually get mad. You know, like, because we tell us to contact these all the time, because one of the things we teach Thomas to contact these is a way to get answers. It's a little trick we learned a couple of decades ago how to get answers from ET. And sometimes ET don't have a problem with it. As a matter of fact, sometimes ET acts like pride, top, oh, look, man, my contactee figured out how to do this. But sometimes they get very, very, very perturbed. And there is punishment for that. And I've talked to several contactees about this over in the last few years about this. And they just get pissed is the only way I can say it. And I guess they don't like being tricked. But what we do is we'll have a contactee like yourself go to bed at night and program them. We'll, for over like a couple of weeks, we'll program it in their head, and I'll just repeat the same question overnight. What happens is when ET snatches you, since it's all telepathic, as soon as you realize you're being taken, before you even think it subconsciously, you transmit this question. 90% of the time, the alien will transmit it back without ever thinking about it. And that's when they get mad, because you befooled the little gray alien into giving you information that you weren't supposed to have yet. And like I said, sometimes they think it's cool, sometimes they don't. But we've tried this now literally more than 100 times, and it works every time. It's a very, very strange sensation. But we have other ones we've learned that, because, you know, some contactees are being used for stuff. You know, why we call people keepers is because they're serving a job. They actually are in some shape, form, or fashion working with the ETs. And they do know a lot more than the average contactees because, frankly, they're working with the ETs. But even their knowledge is limited, you know. I mean, their knowledge is limited. For me personally, I know I've been being abducted half my damn life, and I can remember if I stretched, pushed, kicked, and screamed, I might be able to remember 30 or 40 hours, maybe 50 hours if I'm lucky. I'll even lie and say 100 hours. But that still leaves, I mean, there's 168 hours in every week. So you do the math. I mean, that leaves tens of thousands of hours where anything could have happened that I just have no recall at all. And I live with a hypnotherapist. Still, I mean, it's tough. It's tough. But now, you know, because I'm interested, like when we were talking about your son, because I have a 25-year-old son who's very intuitive and very telepathic. And sometimes a big pain in his dad's ass because he's too telepathic for his own good. Well, because I'll say something to him sometimes, and you can tell me if this happens to you, by the way. I'll say something to him sometimes. Sometimes something smart butt, or sometimes I'll be aggravated in time. Sometimes I'm in a good mood, but before he thinks, a lot of times he thinks about it in his head before he says it, and man, I'm already answering before it comes out of his mouth. I'm like, dude, you can't say that to your dad.
Yeah, my son's going to be very, I'll tell you something else. My son has this very regal way about him.
Yeah, that comes from the aliens.
And almost as if he's above everybody and everything, although he's not cocky, he just carries himself as if he's, you know, this, you know, people say to him, well, who do you think you are? And it's like, he just has this way about him, and I've got a couple of friends actually listening to this broadcast, and I'm sure they might even send you a message. But it's a way like he'll be at the bottom of the staircase, and I'll walk, you know, upstairs, and he'll notice me and want to, you know, have a question for me, and I'll go to say it, and his comment will be, "Oh, really, Dad?" Like he already knows ahead of time that I'm going to say no, or, you know, and I haven't even said it yet. So it's very, it's strange, this regal attitude and the way he, and it's not a bad thing. I just, you know, for a long time I've really held back on suggesting or making a point of these abilities that, and it's not just, you know, my son, it's my brother's oldest too, and mm-hmm. who's at 20 years old, very close to your son's age, and it's funny to even see them get together, because the way they are, they're so much alike, and yet they're really cousins, but they're both feel like they're at this heightened level, and with the abilities that they've been able to do, not anything extraordinary, but enough that when the two of them are together, you can really pick up that there's something going on here, because there's the way they are, and the way they carry themselves, and the way they look at you, and you know, my son's got hazel eyes, and you know, so do I, and he's got the bleach blonde looking hair, even though it's not bleached, you know, I think I sent you a picture of him actually, and it's just very different, and so I do really believe that this is a byproduct of something, and yet at the same time, I really wish that I could find something to prove that, because it's very different. It's very much prevalent, you know.
I'll tell you what, I'm gonna help you out in your quest. I don't know when the next time we can do this is, but every now and again, when we're attending conferences or things like that, the group will show up. We call it the core group because they're just all contactees and they'll show up. But every now and then we'll do like, you know, local meetings and stuff like that, and people will bring their kids, ages from, you know, 13 to 30 actually. And it's very interesting to see them get together. Because I gotta tell you something about this. They're so much different than the average people would. They're moving around, talking. It's not like if you see a normal group of teenagers or a normal group of people in their 20s or 30s out doing something. They're much more intuitive. They really sense each other's feelings quite a bit more. And after just a few minutes, it's almost like they're long lost buddies, and it's a really, really weird thing to watch. I've seen it enough times now that it doesn't weird me out like it did when I first started seeing it. And it was pointed out by a fellow researcher.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going. It's almost like, you know, I'll give you an example. And if Joe's listening, he can contest to this if he sends an email into you. He does things like, we took some sticky notes and put some numbers on these sticky notes, as silly as this might sound. I think they have four of them or whatever, a six, a five, a three, or whatever, and turned them all face down. I didn't see the numbers, no one saw the numbers, and my son was in another room with a cell phone. And one number was turned over, a second number was turned over, a third one was turned over, they were shuffled around, and one number was still face down. And my son called on his cell phone and told them what that number was. And I'll tell you something else, he did this in front of the STAR team. He did this in front of Max Mitchell, who is an assistant state director in Tennessee, and he also did it with Steve White, who is a Rowan County sheriff, and was with Max, and also working in conjunction with the STAR team. So that's the kind of thing that he can actually do, and I didn't want to stress that too much, because I think that's a little out there, but he's done that on more than one occasion.
Well, you're going to love finding us. See, what you think is out there, we think is normal. You're going to love us, Thomas.
Well, I'm
serious, man.
It fell in my lap, so I'm like still mind-boggled by it. And
I'm listening to you thinking, man, he sounds normal to me. It's hard. I mean, it's hard because I understand it from your point of view as a parent. I do. But I also understand it from my point of view as a researcher as well, so... For me, it's real lucky because I'm a researcher and a parent, so I got the kind of the best of both worlds. But it's when I'm listening to you talking, I'm thinking, oh, God, how many parents have I heard say this? Or how many of contactees' children have I met that are like this? Because we'll do this. Sometimes we'll have the support groups open on Pal Talk. And we'll do stuff like we'll start testing people randomly. So what I'll do is I'll pick a color or a number and send it to a couple people in the room, and then whoever's being tested comes up and tries. Every now and then, boy, you get some good ones too, man. They'll start off with colors, then numbers, then words, then sentences.
Right, right.
I'm like, whoa, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
I'm not that good. I'm pretty good, but I ain't that good. And it's interesting to watch.
We were in Lexington, Kentucky with Travis Walton having dinner at Applebee's or something, and my son comes walking down the hallway, and Travis is trying to figure out the tip, and my son tells him what the tip is, but didn't know what he even had. and it came out that he was right. You know, it was weird, just very weird, you know. And so I'm glad you're understanding what I'm living with, because it's different, and it's
it is different.
To some people, it's really, really off the wall, and I guess in some respects, it's more common than I was aware of.
It's for me, you know, that's the thing for me too, because when I've been in this field for 28 years or 29 years, and when I started in all this, like I said earlier, I thought it was all BS, and then I started watching this progression with time, and then being in research as long as I had been, I've kind of had families grow up in the research. Well, you know, they were little kids when I started interviewing their parents. Now they're grown adults having their own kids. And it's so wild to watch these abilities evolve and how it's different throughout different parents. It's also interesting, Thomas, to watch how families handle it. See, y'all seem like you're handling it fine. You're accepting it, you're dealing with it, you've incorporated it into their lives, which is the most important thing you can do, by the way. Instead of, and parents, if you're listening, this is crucial. Instead of telling your kid they're idiots or they don't have it or they're stupid, encourage them to use it. Watch them develop and watch how much faster their lives improve when they do use them. This is true for contactees, by the way, too, that or abductees coming out. Instead of fighting it, if you let their abilities flow, life will get faster and smoother and much quicker, guys. It's a tough thing. I know most people don't want to think you're being abducted by aliens, because then you got to think you're crazy, but I'm telling you, you're not crazy. And if you don't believe me, I'll invite you down to Gulf Beach, Florida, and you can find out for yourself. How's that? Oh, I'm glad you brought up Travis. Travis, if you're listening tonight, be expecting a phone call, because you're going to be on. We're going to get you on one of these shows for this panel. You know, Thomas, I know you've met Travis and all, and I got to say, I think he's more than a one-timer. You know, I'm going to talk to him about it again. Maybe it's a feeling.
Yeah, well, there's some similarities with his case and mine, which in 69 were only about 4 or 5 years apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have talked about that a little bit, these black rock-type sphere things, and where he was taken out of an open hangar area, which was very similar to what happened with me. So we talk a lot, email each other a lot, and I think we're going to have, had dinner a few times and that kind of thing, and it's one of the few people that I feel a connection to. I think we'll be talking more. We've addressed a, you know, MUFON meeting together, a conference together, there's probably a little more going on there than he's really aware of. I think his new book actually illustrates a lot more than his first one did.
I agree. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to him again, because he broke some stuff on my show last time, which I found was interesting. And we even talked a little bit about MILAB stuff, too, as well, which I found was interesting. But I met him once, I think it was in Roswell, and then I talked to him last time. I just got the distinct feeling that he's not a one-timer. And ladies and gentlemen, I'll be totally honest with you, and Thomas, too. I don't believe there's any such thing as a one-time contactee. I don't think it happens. I don't think they make mistakes like that. And I don't think they just pop you off the side of the road because they want to. I think they take you when they want to take you. And I think it's exactly how it happens. Because there was no reason, if they were truly aliens like we always talk about, there was no reason for them to take Travis if he wasn't a contactee. All they would have to do is fly off in the ship. There was no reason to zap him with the light and take him. Unless they already knew he was who he was. And I asked Travis this. I said, did you ever think while you were driving down that road that they might have known you were coming? By the way, Thomas, that freaked him out. He was kind of like, uh-oh, what? And I'm like, yeah. I said, I don't think you thought about that, did you? And I didn't want to ask him about his kids, because I thought one shocker was enough, man.
Yeah. I know he feels that it was an accidental type of thing and that he was hurt, and they actually, you know, were there to make sure that he didn't, die or something horrible happened. So,
yeah. But, well, I think part of what happened to him was a MILAB. Him and I talked about that. I think part of what happened to him was military, not alien. And when he was the one that actually brought it up. I guess because he knows I do MILAB research. But there was something about the last day and a half, there was something he was saying that rang true to two other cases I was working on, and they weren't alien. They were definitely government. They were these ships in these hangars where these government guys were running around in outfits because of the contaminants from some of the ships from long-term exposure, not from short-term exposure. And they bring the contactees back and forth that way. And there was a couple things that Travis said, and then he told me that three of the people that were on the table with him really looked more like us than anything else.
Yeah, more human-like.
Yeah, more human, not like the human-type aliens, yeah. Well, no, the human-type aliens don't... See, that's where a lot of people get confused. The human-type aliens are human in appearance, but they have, like, six fingers, six toes. They're quite a bit taller than us on average, like a foot and a half taller. They even have different colored eyes, and we do have pupils are shaped differently, which, by the way, I just gave all kind of abduction of criteria out right there. But, yeah, we know that from contactees. We actually know their eye colors are quite distinctively different than ours. And so if you see one of these, yeah, you know you've seen one of them. And they're not going to just walk up and down our streets. They're distinctively different enough that in a shadow or different distance, you would probably ignore it. But if they were in your face, you would realize they ain't one of us. You'd be like, oh, wait a minute.
I don't know if you've gotten emails yet that were sent out, but my son, it looks like a very tan albino.
That's interesting in itself. That's
right eye, very vivid eyes. And matter of fact, even did a couple of modeling jobs way back when in Miami. Did something for Nike and some surfing campaign for Capri Juice. I mean, he looks very. Check your email. It's a very different.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah,
he sounds like one of the hybrids. That's what I was saying earlier. We're the hybrids. I think it just shows more in some people than others for some reason. I'm not exactly sure why either. It's probably something they're doing that brings it out. Also, a lot of contactees feel, now I can't say this is true or not, but a lot of contactees seem to feel long-term exposure on the ships tends to taint your skin, change your eyes, give them an overall different appearance. It has something to do with the air and the type of light that's in the craft. That is sheer speculation. I mean, sheer speculation. It goes, other than what contact you say, I can't find any other, evidence
that
that's true.
I can say this, that the area that I was in, the room and the hall kind of put off its own light. It was just like a glow stick. It just kind of, that's how it was to us. It was just, everything just kind of illuminated and put out its own light. There were no shadows.
It's because it's like the walls make the light or the floors or the ceilings make the light depending on where you are. There's no shadows. It's a really weird thing, by the way. So that helps convince me of you right off the bat.
You've heard that
before? Also abduction. Well, it's abduction criteria. See, a lot of stuff we're talking about tonight, there's a lot of stuff we know that we don't talk about, Thomas, because I got to be honest with you. If we did, I would never know who's telling me the truth and not. If I really sat down with my directors and really put out like 25% of ICAR's abduction criteria, no one would ever know who was telling the truth or lying again. Literally, we have quite a bit of information these days. And so stuff like that, we listen for, we call it keywording when we're doing interviews with contactees. We're keywording. We're listening. You've already hit like 25 already tonight. It's like I said earlier, it's the stuff I expect to hear. And it's just stuff I expect to hear. That's why when I'm doing interviews sometimes, and you'll hear me just get really quiet on the show, it's usually because whatever the person is saying, I'm not just, Mama said, don't say nothing, you can't say nothing nice. So you know how that goes. But I've been listening to you all night, and you've been keywording a lot. So, and that's, we also call it abduction criteria because we use it to determine, if someone's legitimate or if someone's not. Because we do get a lot of reports. Just today, by the way, Michael Saul, if you listen tonight, thanks. I got the phone calls today from the people you referred. I wanted to tell you thank you for that. It was kind of nice to see those pop up on my phone today. Yeah, we're being referred cases all over right now. You know what we're going to do with them all? We've got to get more investigators. We ain't got enough investigators for the workload we're getting. It's getting kind of weird, to be honest with you. But now going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, I was thinking about, on board your ships, because when you said something about the shadows, it reminded me about something else. But for you, do you remember what color the light was? I'm kind of, or roughly what color it was.
Which was this? The color of what?
I mean, on the ship. If you're on the ship, the illumination. I don't want to call it light because it's not light in the sense that we think of light. But
oh no,
do you remember what color it was?
All right. There were two different ones.
Okay.
And when I was young, I was we're going to go back to my first or second experience, which were months within each other. The inside of the wall, when I walked in, this was more of a disc type shape, And I can tell you when I first came in, first of all, when I saw it outside, I was going on this path, which was really weird, and I noticed it through like almost like a wishbone type of a tree, and I saw it through it, and I thought it was a huge pile of black dirt or something, because it was at night, but it was lit up enough for the stars and stuff, you could see it, and your eyes adjust, but it looked like a huge pile of black dirt. And believe it or not, it was pretty tall. And so once inside of it, the area that I came in was fairly wide. I'm going to say it was probably, 15 by 15. It was almost like a white illuminated box and the floor was quiet. The floor, you didn't hear your steps. And, off to the right, it all kind of, again, it was almost like a square tube. And it was fairly, it was high up enough that I was very young too, so things seemed a little bit bigger, so I need to put that into perspective, but it all just kind of, not bright like a bulb, but almost like, like a 2 or 3 watt or 5 watt bulb would look, but the walls themselves were all made or looked like this, and it was all even. It was almost like you know when you have these lights in your ceiling or whatever, and you put these different types of lower panels underneath them, or the bulbs that you get that are more crisp and white, and some for the bathroom maybe, they've got like a frost to it, almost like that. Mm-hmm. And it just, everything just kind of blended into one, and again, you got to the end of this hallway, it stopped, and the light did not bleed into this other room, much darker. It was almost like a slate color, and that's where there were these two tables that were bronze in color, and one almost was a replica of the other one, and they were not that far in front of me, and they were brownish or bronze, and I stayed just inside this area, inside this hallway that was very bright, and where I was dark. And you would think that the light from this hallway would light up this room to some degree, but it didn't. And so that's what it looked like to me, and that's how I remember it. And I remember it fairly vividly. And at the time, we only had a black and white television, so this image that they put across, which wrapped the entire, like from 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock, was enormous and brilliant, almost like today, if you were to look at it and say, okay, well, that represents a huge plasma-type television, a flat screen, which is probably pretty close to what it looked like, and it just wrapped from 3 to 9 o'clock, and it was up for a very short amount of time, and then the image changed. And so I think that room might have been darker because they were going to show me that. Maybe normally it's not. I don't know. But that's what the rooms look like early on to me and to my brother.
That makes sense because they're just, I don't really, it's hard to put into words. I was listening to you. It's the way they light us is almost like, it's almost like everything is luminous, and they can control how luminous it is in different areas. But notice on some of the, like when you were talking about the saucer, I consider the saucers standard pickup shifts, for lack of a better description. I'm sure they call them scouts or something like that, but I consider them like, because, that's usually what comes and gets most people I guess you would just call it the standard everyday saucer. I mean, that's not really a name for it. But it seems that's what it is, and occasionally you see bigger or smaller, a few other designs, but I know, like with the Greys, they've got their mothership, and then they've got 3 or 4 types of saucers. They're all saucers, they're just different types, and then they've got, I guess, a couple of types of, like, shuttlecraft. They're like tiered pods. I don't know. They're hard to explain. There's a few of those. And then, there's other types of aliens have their own types of ships, too, with the same thing. And then they all seem to have these types of orby, proby things that come in sizes of, like, a marble to a damn house. It's weird to see those, man, because they're just big orbs. I mean, they're not orbs. They're spheres is what they are. Because they're not alive or anything. They're just operated, by the aliens themselves. But it's just weird the way the lighting works, and it's something I wanted to contact you to get in their head, because a lot of people think, well, it's like when someone comes and tells me, well, I was abducted by aliens, and they had a fluorescent light over my head, and I was like, really?
Were there any humans around? That's the first thing out of my mouth. Where was the government guys at, buddy? You know, I want to know where they were. On that first, how old were you on the first one?
I was six.
Okay. That's the reason I was asking, five, six, six is the average age.
Six and seven.
Yeah, because that's where it seems to start for some reason. The youngest start I can remember of anybody reporting is four. The oldest was around seven or eight. But in that little four to seven area seems to be when they start.
My brother was four.
They probably took you when you were in your mother's womb still. They probably took you to the ship and checked you out. But as far as our memories go, it seems to start around that age. And it's weird. And some kids take to it better than others. But I got to tell you, the majority of kids we've interviewed, and you can tell me if this was true for you and your brother, didn't have much fear. It's not that they didn't have any fear. They just didn't. For what was happening to them, there should have been a much deeper fear. A lot of them even considered them some kind of, I hate using the word friend, but a lot of them described them like that. For some reason, kids didn't have a fear.
This is, and I know you've heard, I'm sure you've heard a few of my interviews, but what it was like, and I don't want to spend too much, let me know if I'm taking up too much time.
No, take as much, always Thomas, when you're on the show, remember, because you got to listen to my mouth, always take as much time as you need. Okay?
Yeah, we're going to have to do this again.
Yeah.
What it was like for me, and I'm going to share exactly what the first experience was like, and I remember it, the beginning and the end, very well. It was as if we were sandwiched between two beings. I don't know what they were. They almost looked ghostly to me. One in front of me, one behind my brother. And we had a staircase that went, this was in our house. We had a staircase in the middle of the floor, and we almost had like what looked like a square donut that would wrap around the staircase because there were rooms off the back side. I really thought we were first of all, it was a calm. There's always been a calm until one point when there wasn't, and it was much different, but there was a calm, and we cooperated, and it was almost as if it was okay, and like you said, we weren't scared for some reason, and we should have been petrified, right? So this line that we were in started, you know, the first one moved out, and we took what we remember is about two or three steps, and the scenery around us really had changed, and we were at the top of this property line walking out of this, which seemed like we took maybe six steps in total, and we were from our house and 100 yards away. That's what it was like. And when we got to this property line, we were breaking into this tree line, there was a path, which I actually went and visited about 6 months ago, and I actually took my son and showed him where it was. And pretty much the same thing. I remembered a campsite with some stones that I had never seen before. I rode my horse up there a day or so later, and I knew exactly where it was because I saw the campsite, and I had never been there before. And there was a huge boulder that I actually had a picture of myself standing on later on, which is the boulder that we walked by. So I knew exactly where it was and had never been there before, except for this evening. And in the same principle kind of took place. It's like you start to move, and you actually do. We actually walked. We were taking steps, and then you're there in what seems like a matter of seconds. Now, it may not have been a couple of seconds, but it felt that way to us. And that's kind of how we got from point A to point B. And I just don't know how to make sense of that, you know, because I don't remember anything in between. And then in 1969, my mother, my grandmother, my brother and I were in a station wagon, and this was the last time until what we believed to be 2009. So this is 40 years later that this happened in Brownsburg, but the four of us were in a car going down what we believe was Route 7 in Massachusetts, and we saw these lights that looked almost like a floating strip mall. It was enormous, and I was giving my brother a little fireball, you know, those little wrapped candies fireball, and she thought he was too young for it. She had turned around, and was trying to, you know, take it from him and say, you know, you're too young for that, you could choke. And she saw these lights out the back of our station wagon, and we all kind of turned and started looking at them, and it was just enormous. I mean, it literally looked like a floating strip mall with a bank of windows with lights coming out from underneath them, and it looked a flicker because we were driving, it was hitting trees, and you couldn't miss it. And the car came to a slow roll off the side of the road. We heard the stones. I remember the stones from the car, and you know, the engine had stalled, the radio went off, and you could hear rocks under the tires. And all of a sudden, these crickets were unbelievably loud. I mean, you could, even in a car, it would drive you nuts if you had listened to it for too long. You know, these crickets were all seemed to be just louder than I've ever heard before. And the next thing we know, we were all in this larger, you know, craft, and we were separated. I was taken down a hall into one room, and I can get into the detail on that later. But, you know, it was... this was a totally different craft, and this craft where I first had gotten into was much darker, but the walls were the same. Once I got into that area, the hallways all seemed to have this same pattern of this self-illuminating bright light, and it was just very, you know, the same but different. This craft was huge, and I had run out into a hallway that was in the shape of a Y, and in the center of this Y was probably about the size of a basketball auditorium, if not bigger. There were markings on the floor which resembled like a crescent moon around some of these turns that you would go. I came out not in the middle of the Y, I came a little off center, and I could hear voices, which was very different, and listened to see if I could hear my mother, and that's when I was brought back. But it was very, every room in this, or every hallway in every area that I had really seen was huge, except this room that I was actually taken to. So
it's weird because, sorry, I almost lost you there for a second. That was weird. No, I almost lost you there for a minute. I was listening to you and went to go answer you and hit something, almost turned us all off there for a second. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. I was getting into what he was saying and not paying attention to what I was doing. But that reminds me, we got to do a quick station ID because we skipped the top of the hour. So, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on UPRN 105.7 out of New Orleans. I hope y'all are enjoying the show this evening. And by the way, tomorrow night will be the debut of Second Sight's 2-hour premiere. They just debuted in the network a few weeks back as a rerun or a syndicated show. And then they've, about 2 weeks ago, they started live at a 1-hour show. And this Tuesday, they will be in a 2-hour show, and they will be discussing exorcism. Can't wait to hear that one myself, ladies and gentlemen. So be sure to tune in, 7 to 9 o'clock Central Time on the Paranormal Radio Network, Thursday nights. Don't be late. All right, sorry about that, Tom. I forgot. We didn't take a break, so I had to do a little promo there. Usually we take that break, but we had a phone trouble in the beginning, so I didn't want to cut out a time we get, you know, over a little lousy 10-minute
okay.
break.
Are we on
the No, we're still on here. I just had to do the little promo. The FM requires that we do a station. We're actually supposed to do a station ID every like 30 minutes, just to let people know when they're listening, what they're actually listening to. So that's in case we say something that we shouldn't on FM, and they can call the FCC and complain. That's what that's about. By the way, that's all that's about. I was thinking, because a lot of what you're saying just rings so true to me. We could probably actually spend several days talking about just specific things, which our poor audience would probably get bored and fall off the thing. But then again, I might scare the daylights out of them, depending on what we were talking about. But I wanted to ask you, on that particular experience, I was listening to you talk, and I was listening to your tone of voice. What was, how can I say this, what was the overall mood of the experience, the feeling of the experience? What did you come away with? Mad, sad, happy, glad, something?
Well, in six, okay, well, each, there were three.
Okay,
and,
okay.
And the first experience with my brother where he was actually with me, it was more like an indoctrination. It was more like there was there was a need for us, and we felt important. And there was a touch in my left shoulder. And there seemed to be a consoling type of concern or way, if you will. There, I felt almost like they were my friends. Is that, that makes sense? I was calm.
Yeah.
And then the second time, when I was, I'll tell you how this happened. I was in a bedroom with my brother. We were in the middle of a conversation, and my mother had come running in because there were at least flashes, and it looked like lightning strikes outside the house, and the sky lit up for a minute or two, and she came running into our room to check the window to make sure it was closed, because back in, you know, 67, we didn't have air conditioners, so we left the window open. We had a brook in the backyard, and he used to help us go to sleep. It was one of those things, so she shut it, and had said to us, I think it's going to pass. I don't hear thunder, which was how I named my horse Thunder, and I went up and found this area afterwards anyway. But so we were okay. So, you know, we felt assured it was going to pass, and but we couldn't go to sleep. You know, even if a lightning storm, you have that tingling, you have that unrecognizable aura or something that's there. And that's kind of how it felt. We couldn't go to sleep. And my brother was on the top bunk, and I was on the bottom. The lights were out, and we had seen these flickers outside our window. And the next thing that we remember was like a focused light about the size of a coffee can, is the way we picture it. Just fired in the room, and the room ignited in white light. And my brother was talking to an empty bed, and. So this is where they had brought him to me later, after I was very concerned, you know, where he was, and this wasn't quite as consoling, but I was, this is where I believe that I had in some way found a way to frustrate, because even though I was calmer and I was still worried about my brother. And so that situation was a little bit different. It became a little... There was a vibe there where I could tell that it was just not quite as friendly as the first one. And then they did bring my brother to me, and I believe that's why they did it. I certainly can't speak for exactly what happened, but there he was, and then everything seemed to be a little bit better, and we were brought back at the same time. Although we were about 15 feet apart, and then 69 was totally different. I had come in this area that was very much like a, resembled like an airplane hangar, and there were some steel carts to my right, and the area itself was probably like a football field, if I'm correct in my dimensions. It's about what it looked like, but it was empty, and it was dark. And there was a door that I had come in. I believe it was because it was behind me somewhat. I don't remember coming through it, but it was behind me. And there was a door straight ahead, which was, again, about 50 yards away. And a being had come through there and not taken too many steps. I mean, it was only like just barely came through, and I knew that I was to walk. You know, I knew that I was to go to him. And usually when that happened, or I was getting closer or becoming closing that gap, there was this calm that would come over you, and I keep going back to that because that's kind of how it feels. You just feel like it's okay, it's going to be all right, and all of a sudden you feel relaxed, and by the time you get to this individual, you're not that concerned or worried or want to strike out or something. But this one didn't really happen. My left arm was grabbed. I was... turned and brought out this doorway, and immediately brought down this hallway, which again I had mentioned earlier kind of looked like that squarish tube. And I wasn't like, normally they always walk to my left. Every time I've been had anything happen, they've walked to my left side. And I was taken down this walkway, and I took a left, and which wasn't that much further down, and then immediately into a right, and there were these two that were completely different. I've actually sketched this out when I was in fourth grade, drew these images that looked like a bronze or gold egghead type shaped head, like more like a teardrop body, and legs and arms kind of stemmed lower in the body. And there were two of them facing the wall. So when I came in, I had actually passed them, and they were off to my left, but very close to this wall. And I was sat up on this table. And I knew this was totally different. I was very uneasy. I was very uncomfortable. And now this was actually the third time that something like this had happened to me, but I was almost 10 at this point. And it was, the feeling was different. It was cold. When I was looked at, it was almost like the panning of a security camera. You know, it was like I wasn't there. It was just like I was just part of the room. Anyway, this is when I ran out into that hallway and had brought back in. And they had placed these little, whitish, milky white type pads of some sort with this black thing on top, which I referred to as a rock. And it was placed on my leg and my side and my head. And I believe that's kind of what sedated me. This thing came over me and kind of held me in place, which I think was keep me from running again. And that was really the majority of it. But that incident was nothing like what had happened prior. I mean, it almost started in a way that it was a nice, friendly, you know, if there is a way to word that, but something that was going to set us up maybe for something later on in life, and so we wouldn't be too alarmed, was kind of how the first thing happened. And I think whatever they maybe found in my brother and I at that point was why they had me for go first. And of course, at the time, you know, my brother and I would talk about this, even though it was a little bit difficult. It wasn't like you could totally share it with family, although my mother would, again, reveal what happened to her in Moosehead Lake and how there was like a curtain or a curtain over her of light that almost encompassed her like a rainbow of lights that were over her bed, but all white, almost like a blanketed in light. And so we started talking about it, and that's when we had these saw the image of a willow tree. And then my mother, who was not with us to see this willow tree image that we believe, she went out and bought a willow tree and planted it at this little pond in the not far from the kitchen window. So that was kind of peculiar too. But the feeling that my mother had, she was actually, what happened with her, she was actually able to move her hands and feet, but felt like she was confined to like a mannequin where she couldn't really expand. She had trouble swallowing, but she grabbed a blanket and she's trying to pull herself, is the way she's written a lot to me about it, and how the ball of the blanket just kind of balled up in her hand when she was trying to pull away, not knowing where she was going to go. But her experience was the same night that she had this experience, another girl who she really did barely knew, was dating her brother in the cottage, had the same experience on the same night, and their experience was a little more horrific. It was very traumatizing, whereas our first was not. It was, it probably should have been, but it wasn't. And the second one was not that horrifying either. It was just where we actually found that we could frustrate or noticed afterwards that we had been able to frustrate them. And then what happened in 69 happened with the entire family. And then, of course, 69 is when they found, you know, they had better testing equipment, and they found a lot more of the tangible supporting documentations and so on and so forth. So it did definitely start with my mother. So we've got my grandmother involved, my mother, myself, and our children, which is four generations, actually, and over a span of 50 years.
And see, cases like yours are what we're always looking for. Anytime there's more than two or three generations, we're always looking for. Because it's cases like y'all. See, you just did part of my job for me. You're showing the progression from grandmother to mother to child to grandchild. It's interesting to watch that. I mean, it's interesting because you were talking about like a friend and all. And I gotta say, 95% of most of the children I talk to almost always say it's non-threatening, non-violent. They consider them friends. They really do. I've even heard my own son say this when he was three. Oh, look, my little gray friends are coming, which, by the way, freaked me out. But anyway, enough about that. But still, I mean, I've heard it countless times. But then, sometimes it changes, sometimes it doesn't. It really depends what they're going to use a child for. Around puberty, up until about age 28, and a lot of times they block this out and don't let them remember anyway, is when they do a lot of the, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, it's not that this is bad, it's just it's intrusive. They do a lot of the more mental experiments, and they really test their hard, their mental and psychic abilities and how far they can be pushed. They're also testing a lot of their physical abilities, but this is also part of the time when they're using them for whatever breeding programs that they're running. Sometimes they'll let them remember bits and pieces. Most of the time they will not, and I tell this to every contactee. There's no need to be regressed for that because there's nothing in there you want to remember. Trust me. There's just nothing there you want to remember. Leave it alone. It's the best thing you can do. But you know, some of the youngins want to know and some of them don't. And sometimes it doesn't happen to them. It really depends on what they're going to do with the individual contactee. But being what your son is, I imagine he's going through some of it because he's bright enough on their end that they can use him as part of the breeding experiment. So, you know, unfortunately, like the milking machine and a couple other things that they do, you know, they're more humiliating than they are actually painful or nightmarish. You know, it's just, they don't have humility. They don't really have the concept of humility, at least not the way we do. You know, I don't think they really think there's anything wrong with dragging people around naked and stuff. I don't think for the grays it's a big deal. It is for you. Yeah, you know, so it's one of them things. And I think that's more of what goes on there. But, you know, when you're 20, 25, 18, you know, something got you dragging around a spaceship, you know, naked and hooking you up to some kind of milk machine, yeah, you might get a little like, what the hell? I can understand. It's just best just to leave those experiences out, which is probably a better thing to do. And as your son sounds like he's developing the psychic abilities, they're really so nice there. Because I use them, I gotta be honest, I use mine for like controlling of my dreams. So I can take like a vacation in my head. Because I like to dream about specific things. Like if I'm working on a case, I'll put the details in my head and dream about it. Or something to do at work, I'll put it in my head and dream about it. Or it's just something I learned to do at a very young age, and it works really well for me. You know, I'm surprised that I didn't dream that much yet. But these are all things he'll learn to use and use on a daily basis and won't even think. What's going to be good about it for him, Thomas, is he's going to be able to do this. He's not going to even think about it. It's like you're talking about being regal and loyal. That's why. Because the confidence is there. He knows the abilities are there.
Let me tell you something else. He wants to be a doctor.
That's a good job.
Suddenly he has like this real passion for people and animals. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I sent you this picture, and if you didn't see it yet, I'm sure you will. Now, this is going to sound crazy too, but in a different way. He walked up to a 270-pound Siberian tiger. He petted it and was able to sit in a lawn chair with it. And actually, the tiger walked up onto the lawn chair and laid in a lawn chair with my son when he was... This was in 2006. Now, I sent you the pictures. I had more than one. And...
They must have went to my other computer because I was trying to dig them out a little while ago, but they must have went to one of my other computers. Now, the only downside to having eight computers there.
Yeah, but some people they're like, well, you know, they just don't flat out believe it. But I've got pictures. I got several pictures of him feeding the babies with a milk bottle. I mean, he just was able to, for whatever reason. And I remember this was a tiger that was tied to a palm tree in Palm Beach. And we had been able to see it. And so he just kind of walked over to where it was. And, it was kind of lazy acting and stuff. But, I didn't even see him actually go up to it first. When I saw him, the chain was, on the ground. I mean, the thing could have mauled him. And he was petting it. He was just stroking its head, and then walked over past it, sat in a lawn chair, and the tiger came up to him and sat on the lawn chair. And I sent that picture to you. I've actually used it in my PowerPoint presentations because I'm beginning to really believe more and more and starting to voice more than I probably should about this connection with my son, because if you point out, yeah, he did great Zenicards, or he could pick some numbers from the other room, or his... amazing numbers and where he was that's documented with the school records. But when you can do that too, I mean, there is definitely something to this. And if you haven't seen those pictures, I'll resend them to you.
Send them to icarcox.net.
All right, well, after you're done here, give me a call. I'll send them to you.
Okay, that'll work. Let me move this over here. It's because I'd like to see. Oh man, whose scary face is that? Sorry, somebody else's picture popped up there. Whoa! Let him contact you.
Have you heard anything like that with animals and?
Contactees are very weird. Contactees, not just animals. Contactees can have calming effects on people. They can walk into a room full of people, and depending on what I've seen this more times than I can count. And this is something that sometimes contactees don't even know they have, so they have to learn about it. But they can walk into a room of people and be in a foul, nasty mood, and all of a sudden the whole damn room will be in that mood. Or they can walk in a room giggling and laughing, and next thing you know, the whole room's going. It flows because they're so empathic. It just flows off of them and it's projected into everybody else's head. And since, as I like to say, normals don't really realize this, they just think it's part of their emotion and they start giggling or laughing or whatever, or crying or whatever. They just don't understand why they're doing it. But I see contactees do this all the time. And with animals especially, they have the ability to calm them. Most animals don't fear contactees, which I find interesting. It's almost like a contactee has the ability to portray to the animal they are not a threat. And the animal doesn't feel threatened and doesn't feel a need to defend itself. You know, and as long as it's not hungry, I don't think there's going to be a problem. At least I haven't seen any.
Right, absolutely. And why I mentioned that was because that's kind of the same calming effect that we had as children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were given this calming effect.
Yeah, they use it, but then we use it. It gets weird because I say they, but when it starts out, you know, they may use it on your parents, they may use it on y'all when you're on board ship, they may even give it to your parents to use without them even knowing it a lot of times, just because it's empathic, you know, then they think calm, or they think, you know, everything needs to be quiet. A lot of times it'll just get that way because it's being projected. But eventually, everyone else learns how to do it too. You know, whether it's a year, 5 years, 10 years, I mean, everybody's got their own learning curve, but eventually everybody else learns how to do it. And usually families are so close that they tend to learn these things very quickly, and they tend to learn them, you know, in groups or bunched up. So not always, mind you. There's always an exception to every rule, but most of the time that's how it works out. It's just phenomenal to watch. You know, for me, it's hard because 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I looked at this much differently than I do now, but for the sheer amount of contactees I talk to every day really gives me such a different understanding of what's going on now that it even kind of worries me sometimes. Not so much that I think the aliens are here to wipe us out or kill us or anything like that. It just worries me that, you know, there's so few people out there that are really getting the true story, and there's so many people out there that have no idea that what they think is completely wrong in their head. And it's scary. There's a lot of information to think. But we're always looking for cases like y'all. I mean,
now, you have met Jim Sparks?
Yeah, Jim's a friend of mine. Speaking of which, I've got to find out where he's at right now. I thought he was still overseas.
And listen to this one. Where we moved to after we had left Connecticut, we moved to Fort Myers, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And my son was having anomalies, and we were having anomalies in Fort Myers Beach the same time, the same month that Jim Sparks had his abduction experience at Fort Myers Beach. I had gone to a meeting that I had spoken to Mary Zimmer, who was Assistant State Director of MUFON in Miami, who had given me a name of Tim Wilson, who was in Fort Myers. And I had given him some of the drawings and sketches and things that I had kept all my life from the 60s. And not knowing that I had no idea who Jim Sparks was, but apparently there, where we were having anomalies was in things happening with my son right after he was born, that's for another day. Jim had his experience again, you know, at the same time, a mile and a half from my house. And apparently, from what I understand, he had gone to the same group there, And I had given, when I gave these symbols to Tim Wilson, he had forwarded them to Bud Hopkins, who was actually working on a book with Debbie Cobble, Intruders. Mm-hmm. And come to find out, 40 years later, not 40 years later at this point, but this was maybe, 16 years later, she would be the one that was asked to come in and assist the MUFON STAR team investigating our case in Indiana. So that's a weird little tie right there as well. I found that to be somewhat interesting. So there's an awful lot of patterns, and these patterns aren't just coincidence.
Well, because they're not coincidence, and they're not patterns. They're just pulling you where they want. One of the things we learned early on, and this was by accident, by the way, we happened to have been in Gulfbreeze on vacation when all this stuff was going on with Ed Walters. We lost 7 days. 7 days, man. And we got the documentation to prove it because they got the video of us going in the hotel, the video of us and never coming out, and then all of a sudden we were back. I mean, we were just gone for 7 days. And we checked in and never checked out, apparently. It was really wild. But to make a long story short, we were actually there. Yeah, we were actually there when it was going on. And when we started investigating our own case and I started, you know, trying to understand Ed Wallace's case, I realized something. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Because we had a draw to go there. Me and my wife wanted to go. We just wanted to go for no reason, mind you, other than the fact that we wanted to go to Pensacola, Florida, and actually Santa Rosa Island and spend a week. And I'd go up and down the coast.
What was this? How long ago was this?
This was, well, it would be 20 years now. It was the same weekend that Ed Walters made his report. And then a year later, we were down there again on vacation, the same weekend that Unsolved Mysteries was down there interviewing all of the UFO people in the local area. It was just weird the way it worked out, but we realized something. We started getting reports from people from all around the country about being abducted in Gulfbreeze. And what's going on is they're pulling people down here on vacation or whatever, to visit, come, whatever, and they're taking them. And there are people that are getting like 2 days vacation and a whole week of missing. I mean, they don't know what's going on. And it, like I said, their document, like you want, you know, people going into hotels, not having any room service, not spending any money on their credit cards, and then checking out on the last day. And even they're amazed. There's no gas bills, there's no rental car bills, there's no food bills, there's no nothing. But they were obviously in this hotel for 7 days because you've seen them check in. And you never seen them come out. So, you know, things like these really freak us out, and it goes on a lot in Gulfbreeze. I mean, it's a mecca for abduction down there. There's several places in the United States where they draw contactees in, and I think they do because it may be easier for them a lot of times when they're doing like these are kind of like group experiences. They're going to be alien related, but sometimes they'll have MILAD government people there, and I think they pull them all in there. That way they can do everything at one time. And sometimes there's multiple aliens on the locations. So it's some kind of deal they're working with each other. And what they do is instead of going around and picking them up, I guess because they're all different kind of contactees, they just give them the urge to come to that spot. And I can tell you, there's families that tell me they go every year religiously. And they know what's coming, and they go every year religiously. It's crazy. You know, also Lloyd Pye's down there. That's the area of the country he's in. You know, Ed Walters, there's a few other people besides that are down there. Leah Haley and all of them, Kay Wilson. This is another weird one for you. Me and my wife, Leah Haley, Kay Wilson, Jim Sparks, and there's two other famous contactees, all had experiences on the same area of the same beach in the same military base. All of us. And the experiences are almost identical. Yeah. It's an old fort. It's an old Civil War fort and on Santa Rosa Island. We say military because it's a military facility underneath it is where you're being taken. But it's just an old fort, and there's these big double doors. I mean, everybody described everything identically. It was just so freaky weird. And I was doing an interview with Leah Haley about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, and she started telling me about this, and I was actually kind of freaking out on air because what she's saying just happened to us like maybe 6 weeks earlier. And we were just flipping about it. It was wild, but that particular area is a really, really hot area. And like I said, there's other places in the country. There's the Hudson River Valley, which is another hot area. There's a couple of places up around the Great Lakes. It's a very hot area where they draw people. And a couple of places out on the West Coast and a couple of places out in the Midwest where they just pull people in and do these things. And it's very interesting, very strange. But Gulfbreeze seems to be the busiest of all of them for some reason. And also Eglin Air Force Base is there, which is the largest base in the country at 800, it's the largest contained base in the country at 840 square miles. It's not the largest base in the country because the ones out in New Mexico where the testing ranges are actually bigger. And they test everything here that's non-nuclear. Whatever the Air Force has, it's also where Herbert Field is too, which is another interesting facility in itself. It also has like 47 different airfields on it, which like 20 of them have seen different types of crafts. We actually videotaped the saucer on the base, coming into the base actually. So it gives you an idea how hot that area is. And so anywhere, if you're in Florida, anywhere between Pensacola and Tampa to Miami, yeah, it's a pretty good shot. You're being pulled into one of those areas. They're just going to zap you up and do what they want to do. It's freaky because, you know, it's just weird how that works out. And see, and that's another thing. See, you've got a tie to Jim and we got a tie to Jim. And then there's other ties that you're going to find that crisscross in there as well. Matter of fact, I was thinking about this the other day when I had Linda post out the email to invite you on the show. I want to do a panel show with me, you, Jim Sparks, Whitney Strieber, and Travis Walton. Because the four of us, the reason I want to invite Whitney is because I don't know if he's includes in this for us, but the four of us all have something in common, and I would like to see if Whitley actually had it too. So we'll see if we can pull that off or not. And keep your fingers crossed. That would be an interesting show, and it's safe. If you run into any of them before I do, tell them I'm looking for them. Because I'm aware Jim went off to. I thought he was overseas. I know he's back in the States because he's doing the thing out in California, the 2011 Expo, the MUFON Expo. I know he's speaking out there. So,
was he?
I thought he was, yeah. I thought he was on his website the other day.
Symposium.
But I'll catch up with him sooner or later. And I met Jim in Houston. He's I enjoy him talking to him, and see, he's got a lot of similarities that goes on with us, and he fits into a lot of the same stuff. But he got mad at me one night because he was telling me something, and I said, well, yeah, you said you remember 99%. I said, how many hours you remember? He said, a couple of hundred. I said, and let's go through this. I said, you're saying they're taking you 3 or 4 times a week, 5 or 6 hours each time. We'll do that time. I said, that's about 10,000 hours a year, or about 2,000 hours a year time 10 years. That's 20,000 hours. I said, do you have that much memory? And I think for the first time, I realized, oh, shit. Wait a minute. It ain't quite what I thought it was. You know, that's what I'm saying. And that's what happens with contactees. Because some of us have so good a recall, we forget that we only are remembering X amount. We're not remembering what we, you know, 100% or 90%.
Yeah, and what I remember is conscious. This isn't, you know, regression remembering. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the best way to remember, Thomas. I'll be honest with you. You know, it's by far. Don't get me wrong, we'll use regression if there's no other means to extract the information, but we prefer not to. We prefer for you to remember, either through support or dealing with other contactees, or there's many ways to bring out memories, like this show alone. What you and I have talked about tonight, some people will be just listening to, just everyday people will be listening to me and go, you know what, some of that sounds familiar to me, and then they'll write to myself or one of the other researchers in the field and find out, oh, wait a minute, there's something going on in my life. You know, so just how it falls out, but I know we're just about out of time. Any plugs, anything you want to push before we go, or websites or anything like that?
Well, my website is tomreed.info, so it's www.tomreed.info, and I will be at the Scarefest in Lexington this September, and I'll be speaking at MUFON in Atlanta, I believe, in June 11th. But more so than anything, we're really just focusing on my book, Willow Lake, which I'm only in the fourth chapter of it. It's not as easy to write because it's a collective effort from everyone in my family.
Tell me about it. Look, I'll never criticize anybody about a book, Thomas. I've been trying to write a book for 8 years.
Yeah.
And you can see how much luck I've had.
Yeah. I got an article coming out, I guess, in UFO Matrix and possibly UFO Magazine. So there's going to be a lot more with respect to the documentation that was found, the trace evidence, and that sort of thing.
I just wish people like UFO Magazine and then would pick up some of these audio files and put them out there. I mean, because you know, right now you're contactee 8 in the series of 20. And they're all excellent interviews. They're all different, but they're all excellent interviews. And a lot of these, not everybody we're doing is famous, but most of these contactees are famous contactees that are being interviewed in a much different fashion. So, you know, I just don't, I understand all these magazines want to do written stuff, but man, they're missing out. You know, you're getting so much more across tonight, and people can feel insensitive than any article can ever put out. It just, you know, because they lose the emotion is what it is. That's truly what it is. That's why people like these shows so much, because you can sense, right. Like several times tonight. Yeah, well, several times while you were talking about, you could feel either some form of emotion, whatever it was at the time, coming across. Which, you know, it's part of what we do, and it helps people understand it. But actually, ladies and gentlemen, you can also find Thomas's site. It's linked on the UFO on the Cover site. It'll be up there for a few more days for sure. Actually, I think we leave them up almost a week after the show, and then we post up the new guests. So y'all be sure to go over there and pop it out and check it out. Look forward again to seeing him on the show. I'll try to get him back soon. We got to finish the special out. So once that's done, I'll get you back for the panel show, and then after that, me and you actually get together and do just some chit chat, maybe a 3-hour show where we can just kind of sit back and really just talk about a lot of different things. Because I really think there's a lot of stuff that I want to hear you say. I already know it's there. I just want to hear you say it myself. And there's a lot of stuff that you'd probably like to enjoy hearing about some of the crazies we deal with. Well, they're not crazies. They're actually big people. I got to tell you, that's another thing. Most contactees I have met, 99.9% of them are really just good people. They're not evil, they're not bad, they're just good people. A little confused sometimes, right. but good people.
Talk of enough.
And you know, most of them are quite bright, so that's another interesting thing in itself. I'll tell you, now here's a fun one for you. We got a group of them together in Vegas for the Crash Retrieval Conference. And we decided Friday night, there was like 10 or 15 of us in a bar, and we decided as a big group of contactees we're going to get drunk together. We probably drove half a day as much. But it was interesting, because you should have heard some of the stuff that came out in the conversations after that, man. Oh, my God. I wish I had a recorder with me. Oh, man, there was a whole wealth of information coming out. I was like, damn, I hope I remember this in the morning. So I should be taking notes or something. But, man, anyway, I had a great time tonight. You were fantastic. Other than the little audio grip we had in the beginning, we're good, and it's about a two-hour, almost exactly a two-hour archive. And it'll be posted in about 20 minutes, but it's not going to be available until Friday at midnight. If you need a copy, pop me up in here.
I want to send you those pictures of the had mentioned about the tiger and so on. I just really want you to take a look at this. I think you find it.
No, that's not a problem. What I'll do is, as soon as we clear out of here, I'll get Kevin Smith on. I'll give you a call back. Give me about 10 minutes.
You got it, sir.
And I'll give you a yell back again. Thomas, thanks for being on, ladies and gentlemen. I hope y'all enjoyed the show tonight. I had a great time. Thomas was a great guest. Be sure to go out and check out his site. Pop him off in some emails. Put him on a hot seat. Ask him some questions. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy your life. Smile. I promise you. I say this every week. I promise you, if you smile, your face will not crack. Look, just try.